You eventually married? When did you marry?
Did you marry? 1957.
Oh, and then that's
56, 1956.
Oh, and then you came to Burnaby in 57.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, 56, yeah.
Why did you come to Burnaby?
Well, it was sort of a thing. I had polio, you know, when I was a young guy. I was 19 and I got lots of polio, so I was leg brace and all that. So now I wasn't fit for that ruggles of heavy duty labor that I would like to do and I liked, enjoyed doing. And I worked for the telephone company, and this came along, and I didn't think anybody would marry me, but somebody wanted to. So, and they and their friends suggested there was a piece of land out here in Burnaby. I'd never heard of. I'd been to Burnaby before, but I didn't know. And so I come out here, and I loved it right away. There's a mountain view here, and there was a little park here, and I got a big garden area. But I'm totally ignorant of this land, you know. I mean, you got only 18 inches of soil here and lots of rocks. So that was another learning, lots of learning to do with that. What is this all about? Yeah.
Well, what kind of attitudes did you encounter in Burnaby towards the toward land use?
Oh, in those days, it was just brushing and clearing. I mean, here you could see trees all over the place and see Burnaby Mountain was clear, and you could see Kingsway. It was all clear of brush. There was no trees left around at all. It was all cleared off. There was nothing left here. And I could see Kingsway. I could see Simpson Sears, and now I can't see out of my backyard from
The house that you're living in now, is the house that you moved to then?
Well, it was a shack then.
Oh, but it's the same site.
It was the same site, yeah, but it was a little shack on logs. It didn't even have a foundation, it was just on logs. And as time would allow, I kept on building on it and adding to it and lifting it up and pushing, and just as time and necessity allowed.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a learning experience, and
So one of the changes is actually that there are more trees now.
Oh, yes, there, you know, as I said, before I could see, everything was clear, there was no trees. You could see all of, everywhere, like even here, I can't see out of the window here now.
Maybe I know, there's a big
tree
there.
But before I could see down the street, see what's coming,
yes.
And see the whole mountain range from Lions Gate Bridge. I could look out the window here, see Lions Gate Bridge, both loops, and then I could swing right around and see the Golden Ears. Top of Golden Ears, so it was a very, you know, see the old timers, they, especially during the 30s, it was clearing land and cutting wood was, they would get together on their, even in this place, and their friends would get together and there would be a big stump in the front there with no street there, but a big monster stump there, and their friends would get together and hack away at it just for the sake of, gotta cut that stump down, it's there, it's got it, that's what it's there for, is to be cut down, you know. And the old timers were like that. It was a big tree, they cut it down. If it was a big animal, it had to be butchered or shot, you know. And
I'll just stop the recording for a minute. Okay, so we're back at the interview, and you were describing attitudes towards land use when you first came to Burnaby.
Yes.
Yeah. Still, let's clear the land. And
even the councils of the day, you know, they were all, you know, the councils of the day, they were all the types of people who had said, well, for instance, I'll give an example. We had one old-time councillor, his name was Doug Drummond, but the old Doug Drummond, and he felt that the ravines in South Burnaby, that we could make money on it by having Vancouver put their trash and garbage into it and fill the ravines all up, and then we could build a highway on it, and Sunday afternoons we could take a drive along there and have a scenic drive by driving back and forth on there and looking out over the valley, you know, and
yes.
Things like that. And of course I was looking at the ravines there were creeks down there, and of course there was lots of stuff dropped down there, old cars and everything else, and creeks running down in there, and kids used to go down there and play, and they would make rope string a rope right across the ravine, you know, and have a little pulley and swing back and forth. And I used to sort of watch them. What the heck are they doing there? And watching them construct this place, and a great place to play. Then I was talking to some other old timers, and they were telling me about the fish that used to be there. Gee. So then we had a commissioner come on there. His name was Reese Hall. He's passed away, dear friend. He lived down there. And he was quite aggressive about these things. And I said, well, we'll put these, and we're going to, they will be dedicated parks. So we went as a commissioner. Now I'm a commissioner. Now I've got a little bit of some say, but not much say, because the staff were not too eager to listen to us, you know.
Do you know why it was that concerned you so much about having garbage in the ravines?
Well, garbage anywhere in those days used to, right from time I was a kid, I was it bothered me, you know, the kitchen stove being all greasy on the farm, you know, and I used to try to scrape it off, you know, and of course it just made it a worse mess, and I was just always, and my brother was the same way. He was also very clean, and we were brought up on our own, you know, we lived on our own, and he was, you know, more concerned about cleanliness and things like that than I've ever seen any man be. And he always was on batching at construction and all the rest of it, you know, living by himself. And so the ravines, then we started to put the ravines aside, and then I had an organization put together with the schools, what they call cleanup campaigns, to try to clean up the streets and clean up this garbage. And that's, kids would go out with garbage bags and everything and pull out tons of stuff, you know, out of, all over the place. And and the ravines, finally the citizens took a liking to it. They lived in it, and they demanded that the ravines be fixed up because it was caving in, and city relented and started to fix up there so that they weren't dumping their sewage into it, which they used to dump their sewage, and that is the storm sewage and the regular sewage, into the ravines. And they start to clean that up, and step by step. But it took changes, you know. Our manager, city manager, was changed, and he was an engineer, and he had a concern for an environment, Melvin Shelley there. He was a great man. And he made...
What is his name again?
Melvin Shelley. He was out in Delta, I think. He became your manager out there after a while.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and he was a great small man. And he was in the Army, and then he was a civil engineer type of... And he took municipal. And he had a great pension. Then we got another planner into the city, and he was an environmentalist, you know, planning environmentally. So when we brought things like this forward to him, he took note of it, and he'd make things happen. So little bit by little, we were fortunate to have a commission that was concerned. Those were the golden years in the 1970s. With the commission that we had, they were thinking the same way, and then there was a change. We started to change the staff and the city hall. You know, their park staff was changed, and the management was changed, and the city management was changed, and we happened to get good people who were very acceptable to our thoughts about saving the river. I mean, that was a big project, saving the foreshore of the river, you know, for a parkland. I mean, the environment, not the industry, had big eyes on that, and commerce had big eyes on that. There's all sorts of things are going to happen out the ship building, and there was going to be, you name it, the barge building, and everything was going to go on there. And the racetrack, Vancouver wanted a racetrack down there, and everything was there. They had their eyes on that. And then when we come along, we said we wanted the foreshore of the Fraser River from Vancouver to Westminster, and 100 meters wide, and that should be preserved for to preserve the river and lively. There was a shock in the industry. and And the commission of the day, they were all for it, you know. They supported it. And not only that, the manager said, "Now, I said, how can we do it? They want hundreds of thousands of dollars, which we only got about $100,000 a year to run our parks." And he got should leave it with me, Tony. And he made it happen. And I just keep out of his way. He knew the business end of it.
So, why do you think there was such a change in attitude towards the land?
Just luck, you know. We had a group of people on the park commission who were very well. We had our booklet out, you know, to the municipality, who the park commissions are, what we are planning to do. We talked to them. We went to their meetings. Of course, there we had our people who were against it, you know. They called us and boo us and all the rest of it. And then it didn't bother me or us, you know. We went ahead. Then we took on the Burrard Inlet. Now, there was only one little area of the Burrard Inlet, the Barnett Beach, you know, maybe 5 acres or something. Well, I said, we went all the way on the Fraser. I said, a little 5 acres here. There's nothing here. I mean, you get a few hundred people here and it's already full up, you know.
Oh, this is the Barnett Park area.
Yeah, and I said, we need to have a linear park. So the planner says, well, what the heck is a linear park? I said, well, one park runs into another.
Well, now, how did you know about linear parks?
I was down to Washington, D.C., and there was a little group of people. We went down to Potomac there, and the planner there was planning a park. And now down there, you know, to spend money, something like this, unless it's bringing money in, it's not. But he had his plans where he was going to a series of parks along the way, and he called it Linear Park. And so linear, I had to look it up right away what it means, you know, linear, you know. And I still have pictures of it in a photograph I had when he had his big picture out, or his map out there, and he was showing it.
And how did you meet him? How what was the
well? Occasion? It was a park convention, I just happened to be one to be able to go there at this time. A take on it was known as the Canadian Parks and Recreation Association, and we were associated with the Americans, you know.
Okay, so this was still in the 1970s.
Yeah, still 1970s.
So you were learning a lot as you went along.
I what I learned there is, don't think just small park like 2 acres or something like this. If you're going to have a park, and if it's going to be successful, it's got to be big. It's got to involve a lot more than that little pocket, you know. You got to involve the trees and the migration of birds, or maybe the migration of how children get to or from it, you know, and all these sorts of things have to be considered, you know. If you have a park here where everybody has to come here by car because there's no way to get here, in the olden days they used to go across people's backyards, you know, and people would be annoyed at that, you know, and they were known as the grumps, you know, so they kept away from that yard, or they go there to tease them, you know, but they would whistle out and they'd come from that yard, and they had all kids had all trails all over the place to get to the park, because they knew when things were happening at the park or something, and they were just coming in from all directions. Now, that's all wired off, and they have to come in by car and park there, and they don't let their children run across somebody else's yard. I mean, that was considered sinful or whatever it is, but you would never think of kids. Kids like to do that. They like to go and see what's happening in other places. They're very, I watch my grandchildren, they're very, they want to see what's going on. They'll sneak along the fences and look what's in the yard and look there, and they do this so many times that they come home and tell you what's those people neighbors got and what those people neighbors got, and or they won't tell you anything what's happening that they don't want you to know, you know. So the kids are they really have changed a lot. We've changed them. We got them worried that they would be kidnapped, and there was some kidnapping, so that that made a big change. Everybody's watching their children like crazy, you know, and they don't allow them to get together. Before, I remember even in the orphanage when I was there, I was a small tyke there, and we'd have strangers come up to the fence there and look, and there'd be about half a dozen kids there would be all there and checking him out, who he was, where he was from, and what's he got, and reaching into his pocket to see if he's got some. Oh yeah, and they were, they, you know, they were little gangsters. They were just like, what are those cats called with the tails up in the air in Africa, you know, where they go in a band, you know, and they're just always together as a band, and they take everything on, the meerkats, I think they're called, and they take everything on, and yeah, they investigate them. Kids learn a lot that way. They know their neighborhood so well.